This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our Radio Main Street across North Dakota. Today we're going to start our show talking with somebody who knows a lot about putting on shows. It's Jade Nielsen, the president, the founder, and as he calls himself, the talent buyer for Jade Presents, which has been putting on stage shows, concerts, events for 30 plus years, and he joins us by phone. Jade, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for the invite. I appreciate that.
As I mentioned, you've been in the business of concert promotion, ticket sales, and stage support for a long time. How many people do you employ?
Pre-pandemic?
Sure.
I'm sort of joking, but not. You know, so we have, in my office, I have a team of approximately 16 full-time. And through a little bit of this chaos, we've had a couple people leave for a variety of reasons. So I think we're at 11 or 12 at this point for the promoter side. But we employ a couple hundred part-timers, mostly for the summer season when we're more busy and active doing outdoor events and that sort of thing.
So at this point, that's probably been the employment group that has been most affected?
Absolutely. You know, a lot of that group, which most of them work for a sister company of ours called Nocturnal Resources that does a lot of staffing for events, not just for us, but for the Fargo Dome and other arenas and events in the area. A lot of them have other jobs. This is a part-time job, but it's hit them pretty hard. I've heard from a lot of them, they're collecting unemployment or looking for additional work at this point until we can get back into doing live events.
How would you describe the region or the area you serve? How big is it?
Years ago, I would bounce all around the country. I sometimes say my previous life, I was doing shows in Hawaii and Canada and Alaska and Florida and all over. But
wow.
In the last few years, we've really made an active sort of change in our market to really just focus on Fargo, Moorhead, West Fargo. And that's been strategic for a couple of reasons. One, just because of my industry kind of changing and there being a couple of very large international promoters that have really dove into markets, let's say Omaha, Nebraska, where we used to be active. And so part of that is due to competition, and part of that is just a change in lifestyle for me. I have three kids under 12, and I didn't want to do as much traveling. We occasionally will jump into Bismarck or Minot or Grand Forks from time to time as well, but we are definitely a North Dakota entity.
How far ahead do you work?
In some cases now, we'll work about a year in advance, very rarely much more than a year in advance. Most touring events are booked more like 3 to 6 months in advance, however.
I went up on your Jade Presents website and I noticed that you had rescheduled a lot of events that had been initially scheduled for pandemic time, March and on, and they've been rescheduled to maybe September, October. Are you reevaluating any of that at this point?
Yes. I mean, we keep in mind that we're not the sole decision maker. Often cases we're working with a local venue that we don't manage. So if we use the Fargo Theater as an example, we have to have discussions with them about what they're comfortable with and when they're comfortable sort of getting back to welcoming audiences back in. And then the same thing for any other venue. So we work with the venue, we work with the artist itself. And then certainly in this particular case, we work with the city or state, depending on what the restrictions may be and protection for all parties involved. So it's a multifaceted approach and something that has been intriguing to navigate. I think for this fall, you know, we're feeling at this point that basically all of August is most certainly going away. We're hopeful that we'll be able to do some outdoor events in September, potentially, maybe early October. And as far as going back to doing indoor events, maybe November, December, but it's a wait and see approach at this point.
The pandemic has upended everything for everybody, it seems. How has it changed how you would normally plan your 2021 lineup?
For example, our summer amphitheater season for Bluestem, which was basically, it hadn't all been made public, but we essentially had the full schedule wrapped up. Almost all of that is pushing into 2021. This week, we announced a new date for Alabama that then moved from, I think it was June 5 of this year to June 4 of 2021. We're still navigating some of those waters because it's a matter of working with the artist and finding out how it could work. If they're pushing an entire tour from 2020 to 2021, then obviously they have to reroute the whole thing and make sure that they have venues that line up with the dates they need and that sort of thing. So right now we've confirmed some things in September of 2021, which is certainly not the norm for us. We're typically not working quite that far out.
Have you been since March, since this all sort of started to develop, been able to stage entertainment that follows social distancing and other pandemic guidelines?
The only live event we did a 701 day, sort of a celebration of North Dakota and tied into our area code. We did that at Fargo Brewing with three local artists, had hand washing stations and suggested masks and did all of that. So we did one successful outdoor event. Now, keeping in mind it was 250 people, it was a relatively small audience and certainly not, you know, national act that's going to draw thousands of people, but we wanted to test the waters and try it. And it worked. We've done some virtual events, but it's certainly none of that is kind of the norm of what we're used to.
When things were normal, what's the biggest event you've ever put on?
Well, I've been involved with a number of the Fargo Dome events that have been in that 10 to 15,000 patrons. We did a small tour with Tom Petty a few years ago that played arenas. And so we've certainly done a decent amount of arena acts. I still don't know how that's going to come back.
Yeah.
In fact, I just got off the phone with a colleague of mine with Live Nation, which of course is the biggest promoter in the world. And we were just talking about what I'm going through versus what he's going through. And he's in the same boat. He's rescheduling Guns N' Roses and Cher and all these major acts at the Fargo Dome. And they're trying to determine, are they going to be able to sell every seat or every other row, or what does this mean? It's certainly a lot of unknowns right now that we're trying to get through.
Have your enterprises benefited in any way from the CARES Act or other pandemic relief initiatives?
Yes. I mean, we certainly have gotten some support. The PPP loan program, we were able to capitalize on that and keep our team intact for a number of additional weeks that we didn't think we were going to be able to. And we have had some luck with the SBA and some of their financing. It's been helpful. We are involved with a group called NEVA that's trying to get some additional congressional support right now for the live entertainment business, because as most businesses, at least in the North Dakota side, are kind of starting to open up and get back to some sense of normalcy, we don't foresee that until probably sometime in 2021. So that means we're going to be essentially going 9+ months with little to no revenue at all. So NEVA has been working with Congress on a couple of bills that could assist us in covering some operational expenses and giving us some potential tax breaks, because as promoters, we've all refunded millions of dollars of tickets in the last 9 months. We have our fingers crossed that some of that will be part of the next relief bill that I think is being discussed right now.
Jade Nielsen is with Jade Presents. He's the president, founder, and as he says, talent buyer. And we're talking about the pandemic's effect. Let's talk about when business was normal for most of your 30-plus years in this industry. When you put together a show, or for that matter, a season, what would be your recipe for success? What are you looking for?
We're in a relatively small market in the sense of the entire U.S. Fargo, Moorhead, West Fargo, using that as an example, is considered a tertiary market. So with that, What we try to do is put together the best variety of entertainment we can. We need to be fairly careful that we don't have a number of country acts that are too close to one another in date, for example, or too high priced or that sort of thing, because we need all events, or we hope that most events will be financially successful. So diversity is key. Beyond that, it's trying to find a price point and a ticket price that both can work for the patron and for our community, but at the same point, cover the risk on doing the event. That's probably one of the most challenging things that we navigate that I think most concert-going patrons don't understand. As a promoter, we take risk on every show. So, for example, if we're paying an artist to play Bluestem $150,000, which is fairly common, then we have to figure out how to price the tickets in such a way that we can pay not only artists, but the advertising, the rent of the venue, and all those other costs that come into play, and still come out on the backside and make some money for us.
When you have these outdoor performances, sometimes the weather can intervene and make it impossible. Do you carry insurance to cover cancellation due to weather or illness or a no-show, for that matter?
The insurance for cancellation tends to be very, very expensive. And then, of course, typically wouldn't cover something like a pandemic like this. So it's challenging. We do occasionally do weather insurance, rain insurance, and those sort of things we have done in the past. And it's hit and miss, of course, on whether that has made sense or not. But cancellation insurance is challenging because you get into the health of the artist and all other kinds of dynamics, which just makes it entirely too expensive for one particular event.
Do you network with other promoters? Can you bootstrap one promoter's concert with your schedule to get a break on costs?
There's a little bit of that involved when the agent is routing a tour. Their intent is to route it in such a way that it's going to be cost effective for what their costs are on the road. So, you know, they might play a Minneapolis show along with Fargo, let's say, and they may get paid more for the Minneapolis show because it's a larger market or something along those lines. From the touring perspective, that does come into play. But generally speaking, they don't really look at, we'll play Fargo because we're already obligated to play Minneapolis. It's usually going to be part of a larger tour, and they're trying to kind of average their pay over the course of 30 shows. The one thing that doesn't happen very often these days, but used to more so, is where artists would sort of fly in and do a show here and then maybe fly to Minneapolis and do a show there. There's very little what's normally termed kind of one-off performances these days, you know, where we might be able to capitalize on somebody playing Minneapolis for big money, for example, and then we get them for pennies on the dollar in Fargo. That, I think that the business has gotten very savvy, and agents and managers just don't do that too much anymore. And that's part of the issue right now that we're facing too. You know, even if North Dakota, for example, is relatively safe, you know, as some people perceive it, versus Minnesota or even some of the hot spots in the country, we're still at the liberty of tours. And so if an artist can get on a bus or can't play, let's say, Illinois or Minnesota or some of these other states around us, they're not just going to deadhead to play North Dakota. And so that's one of the things we're up against, and why where business activity to some degree is happening throughout our state. It's not that easy to just call up Brad Paisley, for example, and say, hey, come play North Dakota because it's safe here. Well, the cost would be prohibitive for somebody to come in and play one particular show. So it's challenging, and it's a matter of navigating all those waters.
A lot has been written about the eccentricities of some performers or the odd elements in their contracts. Have you encountered strange requests?
I think to some degree. You know, I've done a couple of tours on a bus, and so I think that I have a little bit of a unique perspective to that. I'm very much a creature of habit, and so I think that's the case with some artists. And so therefore, if you're going to be on a bus and you're going to wake up in a new town every day, there's certain things that you want or certain things that make you feel comfortable in that new space that you need. And so I think a lot of that, you know, in years back was kind of blown out of proportion, where you would see crazy stories of only certain color of M&Ms in a bowl in a dressing room or something. But I don't see that stuff too much these days. I think the great majority of what we see are fairly common things, where, let's say, an arena, you know, they want the dressing room to have a lot of plants and soft light and things along those lines. And I think if you spent every evening traveling and sleeping on a bus from one city to the next, and you woke up the next day and walked into a concrete locker room, it wouldn't be long before you'd probably be going a little crazy. So those things I think we get used to, and I don't look at those as odd anymore. There's still an occasional contract rider that comes up of the artist wants no photos taken of them when they're not on stage, and the sort of privacy things. But I think the crazy stories of yesterday are pretty well long gone at this point.
In the past, concert crowds have occasionally gotten out of control, and I suppose this depends on the kind of performer and the size of the venue and all that sort of stuff. But when do you decide, and how do you decide how much security is necessary for a certain kind of stage deck?
That's a navigating item between us as the promoter, the venue in some cases, and the artist. Certain artists, let's say, will have a security rider that is oftentimes part of their contract, which will specify certain numbers or locations or those sort of things that they're adamant about for their safety. And then we work with the venue, because each venue is a little unique too on entrances and exits in and out and how to properly secure the facility. And then the same thing as, you know, as far as patron safety. And in some cases, if it's a publicly owned venue, the police department might have some say too. It really depends on the style of music, the venue you're in, the particular artist, and all of those factors come into it. Pretty detailed, you know. And then a few years ago, when there started to be, you know, some mass shootings and things along those lines at events as well, as you might imagine, things kind of tightened up, where you're seeing more metal detectors at venue entrances and more safety precautions along those lines as well.
WeFest was sold to a corporation that puts on big festivals, and you mentioned Live Nation. Is a concert promotion business moving toward this kind of consolidation everywhere?
My understanding, first on WeFest, I believe they intend to do an event in 2021. I also not quite sure when we get a vaccine and when live events go back to happening again. But like most industries, I mean, there has definitely been a lot of consolidation. Companies like Live Nation and AEG, which are the two largest promoters in the world, have bought additional promoters and expanded their footprints in a variety of ways. So I'm pretty content being a small fish in a small sea, so to speak, in North Dakota, where there isn't a lot of competition. And I work well with other promoters. So we work with other promoters that come into the Fargo Dome and the Fargo Theater and other venues in the state and either partner with them or work with them in some capacity. And I'm pretty content with that for the time being.
Jade Nielsen is the president founder of Jade Presents. You can find out more about his concert schedule and the way the events have been rescheduled at jadepresents.com. Find out more about his other enterprises at jadecompanies.com. Jade, thanks for spending time with us today.
Thank you. I appreciate it. I love the show. I love the state, and I'm happy to be a guest anytime.
Mm-hmm.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a distinguished professor of history, an author, and a researcher of folk songs. The Plains Folk essays he writes and voices for our listeners demonstrate his skill at sharing history in an entertaining way. For example, today's exploration of a ballad known on our side of the world as the Buffalo Skinners.
'Twas in the town of Jacksboro in the spring of 83. So recounts one of the great ballads of the Great Plains, the Buffalo Skinners, also known as the Range of the Buffalo. 'Tis the tale of an unfortunate lot of men who sign on to spend one summer pleasantly, skinning buffalo on the Texas plains for a man named Crego. The song concludes when they left old Crego's bones to bleach on the range of the buffalo. If you are a documentary film buff, then you may know the Buffalo Skinners figures largely in the musical soundtrack of the 1936 production, The Plow That Broke the Plains. If you do TV trivia, there is even a chance you recall Merle Haggard as the character Cisco Houston singing the ballad in a cantina scene of the 1979 epic Centennial. 'Twas in the spring of 1992 that I disclosed in print that this great American folk song had apparent origins in an episode on the other side of the world, in New Zealand. I had spent most of 1991 rummaging through the manuscript collections of the Turnbull Library in Wellington. Among these were the papers of one Thomas F. Cheeseman, second master of a trading ship called the Buffalo. This was the vessel that in 1836 delivered the original colonists of South Australia to Glenelg, now a suburb of Adelaide. I have clambered around on a cheesy replica of the ship there. After the call in South Australia, the captain needed a cargo, so he put ashore on the North Island of New Zealand and put the crew to work cutting kauri pine for ship masts. The result was a long ballad in which the men recounted their adventures and misadventures. Back home in England, the ballad was published as a broadside, I suspect on the initiative of Cheeseman, who had written the entire text down in his journal. The Voyage of the Buffalo begins. Come all you jolly seamen and listen to my song. The Range of the Buffalo begins. Come all you jolly fellows and listen to my song. Singers and scholars in New Zealand now are aware of this mysterious connection between the New Zealand bush and the Texas plains. Americans are not. The genealogy of the song is indeed complicated. It is tangled up with other songs of work crews, especially the shanty songs of lumberjacks, such as Canada-io and Michigan-io. It is also unclear just how far up and down the plains the Buffalo Skinner ballad spread from Texas. The Texas hide hunters largely operated out of Dodge City, Kansas. Dickinson, North Dakota, later was a great shipping point for buffalo hides, as was Regina, Saskatchewan, the town originally known as Pile of Bones. People in North Dakota know the name of George Will as a horticulturalist who lifted native varieties of crops, such as the Great Northern Bean, and marketed them. He also collected folk songs. He reported to the Journal of American Folklore the text of a shanty song in the same ballad family as the Buffalo Skinners, and another ballad of the Texas Rangers that is obviously derivative from the Buffalo Skinners, but no text of the buffalo skinning ballad itself. I suspect there are missing links out there, and I'm looking for them.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, Tom Brousseau previews the next episode of The Great American Folk Show, and Sue Balcom joins us for Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. West School in Grand Forks will not be used for classroom learning during the 2020 and 21 school year, but the building will serve a purpose. Buildings and Grounds Director Chris Arnold says they plan to use the shuttered school as a storage site for excess school furniture and supplies. That includes everything from file cabinets to tables and chairs. Arnold says they need to minimize classroom clutter to maximize proper social distancing of students due to COVID-19.
So we're able to utilize some storage space to help buy ourselves some space within these classrooms, and we're working directly with each of the building admins and the custodians at each of those schools to start that process as we begin to bring teachers back into those spaces.
Arnold says it's a big undertaking that impacts 1,000 classrooms throughout the district. The closed Carl Ben Eielson School on the Grand Forks Air Force Base can also serve as a giant storage locker for the coming school year. A facilities task force is studying the future of West in light of water, mold, and radon issues that have impacted the school over the past year. A natural gas leak in North Grand Forks this morning forced evacuation of a business and a closure of Gateway Drive. The Grand Forks Fire Department says at 11:05 a.m. it responded to a call at 4850 Gateway. Firefighters found an approximate 2-inch natural gas line leaking after an excavation crew struck the line with a backhoe. Firefighters evacuated Northwest Tire and the surrounding area and monitored levels of natural gas. Gateway Drive was closed temporarily and traffic was rerouted between North 48th and North 51st Streets. Xcel Energy crews arrived and located the leak, and after about an hour, the gas was stopped and levels of natural gas dissipated. No injuries were reported in that incident. And people around the country and here in North Dakota have received packages of unsolicited foreign seeds. The seeds appear to have originated in China. North Dakota Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring says he's heard from at least 40 people who have received the seeds, and he says it's various types of seeds.
Some of it looks like it is noxious weeds. Some of it looks like bird seed, grain millet, all kinds of stuff, and that concerns us. We don't know if there's a pathogen related to this, if it's a noxious or invasive weed. We don't know if it's harmful to plants, other plants, animals, or humans.
Goring says if you have received a pack of these seeds, don't plant them and contact the State Agriculture Department. He says the department will have you send the seeds yourselves or an envelope will be furnished for you.
We're going to do an analysis, work with USDA and APHIS, Animal Plant Health Inspection Service, to determine what's going on here.
Goring says it's not just the U.S. that has been targeted by this. He says a number of other countries have reported the seeds as well. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Paul and Gail Ebeltoft, in celebration of Helen Hollowell's birthday and the joy she brings to her family and friends.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. Singer-songwriter Tom Brousseau created and hosts The Great American Folk Show. Episode 4 airs this Sunday at 5 p.m. Central. He spoke with Ashley Thornburg about how the show is evolving.
Tom, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ashley, for having me back on the program.
I have been really enjoying the progression of the show, and now here we are coming up on Episode 4, and right away I'm struck with one artist in particular that you have, Sunny War. I feel like she's three or four different and equally amazing musicians kind of all at once.
I think you're right about that. When I first heard about Sunny War, I think it was in 2014, I was going to be playing a show with her. At that point in time, Sunny was doing a lot of street performing in the Los Angeles area, downtown Los Angeles and Venice Beach and Santa Monica. That is a kind of an entirely different performer, one who performs out kind of in the busking realm, constantly playing and hoping to make, you know, a few bucks from people passing by. But I think that street performer really must have an incredible repertoire, because essentially all day, all you're doing is playing. In Sunny War's case, this is her to a T, not only does she have her own catalog of original compositions, but she also has a catalog of songs from the hip-hop world, from the folk world, from the punk world, from the country world. At Soundcheck later on that night, that show that we played, she did a version of Johnny Cash's Ring of Fire. And going back to what you just said, Ashley, about how varied this performer is, at first I didn't even recognize the song, Ring of Fire.
Wow, and that's a very famous song.
It's one of the most famous songs in history. I mean, it kind of set the mold for verse to chorus ratio, and I mean, it's got a hook to it. You know, my own personal thoughts about Sunny Moore is that she is just a total original. She's someone who found her way in music, both in singing style and playing style.
Well, let's take a listen to Sunny Moore.
Six, seven, eight, 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. I pick up my phone, don't want no warning. You don't have to apologize. Just put those eyes inside of these eyes. It's all for free. It's all for free.
Your monologue about Sunny Moore, and then I also read a review about her. Both people mentioned very specifically her fingers. What's so special about the way she plays guitar?
The way she plays. So she plays acoustic guitar, six-string guitar. And she doesn't use a finger pick. She just plays with her fingers. Then that kind of comes down to technique. In Sunny Moore's case, because I've studied the technique, I know finger picking, and I know the Merle Travis, Chet Atkins way of picking. They all were influenced by the country blues players in the United States. And the country blues players were players who found their own way playing the acoustic guitar, and then later on it was kind of refined and it became the sort of standard in terms of country music finger playing. But in Sunny Moore's case, there's a lot of bass and there's a lot of treble. Right then and there, I kind of know how many fingers she's using. Mm. And so what was so fun that day was to be able to see that, to be able to see an artist who was obviously very inspired by music from the United States, but who found their way by themselves. I guess what that told me was that she's using her thumb and she's using one finger to play six strings, as opposed to Chet Atkins or Merle Travis, who's using the thumb plus three of their fingers. The thumb can do a lot. The thumb can play, you know, many strings, and that one finger, that index finger, can do the same. I think the pressures of an acoustic guitar player that you think that you need to, you know, go this distance and learn all of these different techniques to be good, when really all you need to do is just kind of find your own way. I know lots of really great players out there. I mean, players that will make your jaw drop. But then when you come across someone who's an original, like Sunny Moore, your jaw drops and your heart sinks at the same time.
Also coming up on episode 4, you make a stop at the Midland Continental Depot Transportation Museum. And just as an aside, featuring Peggy Lee, the great Peggy Lee, the jazz singer, of course, from North Dakota. How come it took you 4 episodes to get to Peggy Lee?
Oh, gosh. It didn't. Peggy Lee was on my list. Chuck Suki was on my list, and some of these other great stops in North Dakota. But I just needed to be the right time to come back to North Dakota to actually visit Wimbledon and to find probably two of the greatest hosts that I could have ever found, Mary Beth Orne and Bethany Andrist. The most charming town. It is kind of out in the middle of nowhere. And in my mind, we always knew where Peggy Lee came from. She came from Wimbledon. But I never knew, Ashley, where exactly Wimbledon was on the map. It was kind of mythical in a way. I think that was a part of North Dakota.
Right, if you don't get off of I-94.
Yeah, because of the name Wimbledon, you just associate it with England.
Tennis great, Peggy Lee.
Yeah, exactly. Out in the middle of this beautiful, really gorgeous part of North Dakota, is this town, Wimbledon, which was, for the most part, made because of this railroad proposition. And just around at that time, this young woman was being raised, Peggy Lee. Long and short, Mary Beth Orne's mother, Myrna Bultema, really cherished this history of not only Peggy Lee, but the railroad in Wimbledon, and she wanted to do something about it. And so they took that old depot and they fixed it up and they made it interactive, and it became in part in celebration and history of the railroad, but the whole upstairs is totally dedicated to Peggy Lee, and it's really quite something. There is no greater place to get the story of Peggy Lee.
And then you also have a song. You mentioned Bethany Andrist. She's Mary Beth Orne's daughter. She's a wonderful singer, very active in Medora as a Burning Hills singer. Did you know Bethany? I know you've done some work in Medora.
I met Bethany a few years ago in Medora. Really wonderful singer and a heck of a dancer, too, I might add. When this idea came up to interview Mary Beth Orne, then, of course, you cannot get out of there without having Bethany Andrist sing a song. Just a really wonderful voice. So to get both of these ladies to be a part of the show, and the spirit of Peggy Lee, I would say, is definitely in there. High honor.
Are you doing all the booking for the Great American Folk Show yourself?
I am. My producer at Prairie Public, Eric Dethridge, has suggested some really great people. As a matter of fact, Letitia Van Zandt was one of his suggestions. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to balance as many of his suggestions in my own pursuits as I can. But for the most part, it's me just reaching out to people, people I know and, you know, people I don't know. You know, I'm more like a kid in that way. I have this belief that I have this faith that if I can get somebody's email or if I can get in touch with their manager, by golly, that person is going to get on the show. So I'm not deterred, and I have a lot of persistence.
Tom, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Ashley. I just love being on your program.
Main Street's Ashley Thornburg with singer-songwriter Tom Brousseau. His Great American Folk Show airs on the Prairie Public Radio Network this Sunday at 5 Central. Up next, Main Street Eats with Sue Balcom.
African Soul American Heart protects orphan girls from South Sudan with medical care and vaccinations, educates them in school and life skills, and empowers them to lead and give back. Information on how to help is available at asahinsudan.org.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton with Ashley Thornburg and Sue Balcom because it's Main Street Eats time.
Sue joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the Root Cellars Farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You are a farmer's market producer, vendor, so I imagine you've been doing a fair amount of harvesting these days.
Oh my gosh, this is like my favorite time of the year. I have grown tomatoes in every place I've ever lived in my entire life. And when I had a child, my very first daughter, my in-laws came to stay with me. And I got up one morning and my father-in-law had picked the first tomatoes that had ripened on the vine, and I thought I was going to blow a cork because that's my job. Holy cow, don't pick my tomatoes. In fact, my husband and I got into it just recently because he's like, it's like you don't want me to pick anything out here. I'm like, because it has to be picked at just the right moment. There are rules about these things.
So when is just the right moment?
Usually before the sun comes up. That's my favorite time to really? Go out and pick in the garden. Yes. Always pick your vegetables at the right time when they're ripe. And you should also pick them in the very cool of the morning. As the day goes on, they heat up. And that kind of isn't good for storage. So if you pick them early in the morning, or okay, if you go out at 9 o'clock, you're probably still okay. I like 5, 5:15. So that's my favorite time of the day. You want to actually get them cooled off as quickly as possible, either in the refrigerator or in a hydro bath, which is simply cold, cold water.
How about zucchini? Because when they get to be baseball bat sized, I don't think they're quite as good as... What's the right size for a zucchini?
4 to 6 inches, because that way you don't have that seed in the inside. And there's nothing wrong with them when they do get larger and produce seed. But I'm telling you, one of the things you really want to do this time of year is get out there in the garden every single day, maybe even twice a day, once in the morning and then once at night. Because if you turn around and look over to the west, that garden is going to pop out another 10-foot zucchini if you're not careful.
Yes, I have to beat the resident groundhog.
Jeepers. Yeah. That's too bad.
Yeah, whatever.
So, okay, so let's say you're going out. This is zucchini start producing probably in the early July, middle of July, and they really do grow fast. So you definitely want to harvest them early when they're young. And you can freeze them. You can make zoodles out of them. There's all kinds of good things you can do. If they get to be too big, you scribe a message in them and leave them on your neighbor's doorstep. anonymously.
Yes. Well, we're coming up on National Sneak a Zucchini onto your neighbor's porch day. And yeah, everybody dress in black. You meet at dusk and you disperse.
Keep the motor running.
Right. When it comes to things like green beans, you can go out and just pull one off and eat it. I like mine young and thin and skinny and tender, but you know, some people like them when they get a little bit bigger. And a lot of times, I don't care who you are, if you're out there harvesting, you're going to miss stuff. Like JC always says, I don't understand why we grow these big cucumbers. Why aren't we going to grow picklers? I'm like, turn around. Boom. There they are. They're big. What can I do? What can I say? Do you want to sleep out here? I think you could see cucumbers grow. And then tomatoes, of course, you always let them ripen on the vine. It's a very important for full flavor to let them ripen on the vines. Now, I don't let mine get too ripe because that red attracts animals. They love the color red, like birds. Oh, look, there's some red things over there. Let's fly down and peck them up. And then they don't eat the whole thing. They just make a hole in one or two on. And you will find that true with mice and voles, too. They're like, oh, this is the nicest spot on this tomato. Let's chew a bite off, and then let's move to the next one.
If you have to pull too hard on a fruit or vegetable, is it ready to be harvested? I mean, are there any tricks to separating it from the stem?
You know, Mother Nature doesn't want to give that stuff up easily. She's like, these are my seeds to make sure that I can grow another plant next year, and I'm fighting you for them. Like, take gooseberries, for instance. My gooseberries were ripe around the middle of July, and oh my gosh, I'm still wearing battle scars from the thorns that were scratching me. I cut my zucchini off with the knife, and I gently pick my tomatoes off. When you are picking, you should be using both of your hands, and they should be clean hands. And you should never pick your tomatoes after having tobacco products, because that tobacco mosaic virus is one that will go from your fingers and smoking to your tomato plant.
Wow.
So you want to make sure you're clean and your tools are clean. Yes, I'll tell you what, if I catch anybody smoking around my tomatoes, they're dead. Because that is a serious disease. And smoking's not good for humans either. So I use a little manicure scissors, a little pruning shears, a regular scissors, and a large butcher knife to harvest, because you do want to be gentle with your plants. You want to hold on to the branches. Don't just walk out there and start pulling things down. You shouldn't even pick apples like that. Mm. You should protect those branches from any damage by gently removing your tomatoes. I cut my zucchini off mostly so that the top doesn't get exposed when the fruit separates from the vine. Sometimes you break a chunk of the top of your zucchini off. I trim my basil down, the outside leaves down, and never let your basil bloom. If you do, it'll quit producing. So you want to keep trimming those down and they'll keep growing for you. Green beans are personal preference, whether you like big fat ones or the skinny tender ones that we're eating right now. The choice is yours, but once again, be careful when you're separating those. If you have a good fingernail, you can pinch those off. to protect your plant.
Sue, if you've got a really good year, and you never know how many beans you're going to get necessarily, because things might have been ideal. So you get lots of beans. Maybe you get so much zucchini that you can't leave it on enough porches. What do you do with an overabundant harvest?
Oh my gosh, you got to learn how to can and freeze and dry and eat. Green beans are great frozen, and that's a fairly simple process. You just blanch them, lay them on a cookie sheet, freeze them, and then a good investment for anyone who's new to gardening this year is a seal a meal. Those seal a meals suck the air out and make a nice airtight package for your freezer, and you don't get all those white watery crystals from putting them in Ziploc bags. And they're fairly inexpensive, and the bags can be reused if you're very careful with them and you clean them out and don't tell the health department I just said that. But if you're just doing it for yourself, there's nothing wrong with that. We recycle every plastic bag in our house, much to the dismay of my children, who say, those are meant to be thrown away. No, they're not. Mm. No. You can process a lot of things like that. Like your rhubarb, you should be constantly picking your rhubarb when they're about a foot long. Don't clean the plant out. That's really a shock to that plant not to have any leaf coverage or any leaves for photosynthesis to keep the roots healthy. But you can take those in the house, wash them off, chop them into pieces for pie, lay them on a cookie sheet, and freeze them individually. What that does is that keeps any moisture from sucking into your seal-a-meal and causing the seal to not seal properly. We've been experimenting with this for a long time now and found out that that's probably the best way to do any kind of berries, rhubarb, green beans, carrots, if you like to freeze carrots. I personally like to pressure can, and I love to pressure can corn. That's one of my favorite crops. Now, here's how you harvest your corn. You want to put a pot on your stove with boiling water and salt. Then you want to run out to the field and you grab six cobs, peel them off really quick, put them in the pot and eat them.
Yep.
Because the minute you pick that cob, it starts to deteriorate and gets starchy. And the same with cucumbers. Like, I'm so picky about picking. But when I pickle cucumbers, I make sure I have the jars, the garlic, the dill, the peppers, the sauce, or the juice, and the canner going. I run out, pick my cucumbers, bring them in, wash them, and get them in jars. It's a very important that you use some of these things up immediately.
I would love to watch you harvest with like Olympic play-by-play sort of like analysis of what she's doing and how fast she's moving.
JC's like, you could slow down a bit, you know, it works just as well if you slow down. And I'm like, no, it's okay. Potatoes. I should talk a little bit about potatoes. Like, potatoes bloom, then the potatoes start really growing. So my friends and I, I've heard them say this 100 times at market. Well, you know, we just go in there and we rob a few new potatoes while the other ones are growing. You kind of like burrow under the plant like you are a vole or a mole, and you pick those little tiny potatoes out and then kind of smooth that dirt over again so nobody knows you are out there. And ta-da, new potatoes until you harvest the ones in October.
We check in with Sue Balcom every week for Main Street Eats. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, guys.
Decoded Date Book is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel of Bismarck, a full-service hotel located in downtown Bismarck. Preparing fresh Midwestern cuisine at the Terrace Restaurant or crafted cocktails and cold beer at the Off-Broadway Lounge. More information on booking your next hotel room online at radisson.com/Bismarck.
This is Decoded Date Book for July 30th. The United States entered World War II in December of 1941, and at that time, most of Europe was occupied by Germany. The continent was considered a fortress, and invasion would not happen for several years. Fortress Europe did not have a roof, however, and American air operations against German-occupied Europe started in 1942. Air missions increased until the Normandy landings in June of 1944 and continued until the war in Europe ended in May of 1945. The American Army Air Force took the war into the German heartland with the 8th Air Force equipped with B-17 and B-24 heavy four-engine bombers that flew out of bases in England. Bombing missions dropped millions of tons of bombs on factories, rail yards, and other military targets. These air operations did not go without cost, however. Thousands of planes were shot down by German fighters and anti-aircraft fire, with tens of thousands of air crew as casualties. During 1943, fewer than one out of four 8th Air Force crew members could expect to complete a tour of duty. 25 combat missions was a tour. Two-thirds of the men could expect to die in combat or be captured by the enemy. The 8th Air Force would have more fatalities than the entire U.S. Marine Corps in the Pacific Theater. Airmen killed in the air were scattered and buried all across Europe. On this date, in 1943, Staff Sergeant George Krueger was a waist gunner on the B-17 bomber called Man of War when it was shot down by German fighter planes near the small village of Opijnen, Holland. Krueger was killed along with seven other crew members and were buried side by side in a small church cemetery by residents of the town. When the war was finally over, airmen's graves were located all across Europe, and remains were either sent back to the States or interred in the large centralized U.S. cemeteries in the liberated countries. The citizens of Opijnen made a request that the graves of the 8 airmen be left to their care in their own little village cemetery. The request was granted, and George Richard Krueger of Hankinson, North Dakota, lies next to his crewmates in the only place in Europe where American airmen who perished as a crew during World War II are buried where they died. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Scott Nelson. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Listen to NPR News at work, even if you're working in your slippers. Ask your smart speaker to play NPR and stay connected at home.
You've got not one, but two streams of Prairie Public to choose from on your smart speaker. Just ask it and listen.
Thank you for joining us today for Main Street. As you've heard me say, as we broadcast, we stream at prairiepublic.org. And after the broadcast, you can find any Main Street show right there at prairiepublic.org. Friday on our show, we'll hold our monthly Journalist Roundtable. Our news director, Dave Thompson, will offer his insights, along with special guests, Steve Wagner, director of the Forum News Service, and Robin Huebner, investigative and enterprise reporter at Forum Communications and WDAY-TV. And Matt Olin will review First Cow, which earned wider distribution after successful showings on the film festival circuit. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.